You're listening to WGXC Acra, Hudson, Catskill, 90.7 FM.
The Catskill Food Pantry is located in the Parish Hall of St. Luke's Episcopal Church at 50 William Street in Catskill. The pantry is open to the public every Friday from 1 to 4 p.m. Healthy food is a right. For more information, please feel welcome to visit the pantry, call us at 551-299-2456, check the website at catskillfoodpantry.org, or connect with us on Facebook at Catskill Food Pantry.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
Wavefarms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Claire in Acre, New York. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Well, I think it's a valid point. I mean, I'm deeply, deeply concerned.
Actor Michael Douglas responding to fellow actor George Clooney's op-ed calling for President Joe Biden to leave the race. Just last month, Clooney, actor Julia Roberts, and former President Barack Obama hosted a $30 million fundraiser for Biden. But in the New York Times, Clooney wrote that the dam has broken. While the White House is trying to turn the page on the president's debate performance, donors say uncertainty around his capacities are growing, with many fearing the down-ballot impact. When asked if Biden should stay in the race, Democratic heavyweight and former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi stopped short of giving a yes or no answer.
It's up to the president to decide if he is going to run. We're all encouraging him to make that decision.
Meanwhile, Michael Bennett of Colorado has become the first Democratic senator to publicly say he lacks confidence in Biden's ability to win.
Donald Trump is on track, I think, to win this election and maybe win it by a landslide and take with him the Senate and the House.
Bennett voiced concerns over polls that show Trump with a lead over Biden less than 4 months before Election Day. House Republicans will likely vote for a bill this week to require people to show proof of citizenship to register to vote, despite a lack of evidence of non-citizen voting. Wisconsin Republican Brian Steele denies charges that the SAVE Act is intended at voter suppression, saying it would strengthen election integrity.
Some will say that illegal voting is already illegal for non-citizens, but it's also illegal to evade the Border Patrol and enter our country illegally. But that hasn't stopped almost anyone.
Progressive New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has moved to impeach Supreme Court Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, pointing to their refusal to recuse themselves even when found to have ties to right-wing megadonors and extremist movements. She calls the apparent bias a threat to the American rule of law.
And that court itself was appointed by the most corrupt president in American history, Donald Trump.
In a letter asking for investigation by a special prosecutor, two Democratic senators accused Thomas of taking a previously undisclosed yacht trip to Russia, paid for by a Republican billionaire. Officials in Nevada's second largest county have refused to accept a primary election recount that confirmed the initial results. Voting rights advocates say the three Republican commissioners in Washoe County are spreading misinformation and undermining fair elections. Commissioner Clara Andriola voted against certification.
There's a lot of information that has been shared that, in my opinion, warrants further investigation. It's not a reflection of anything intentional. I am not an election denier.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We continue our Why People Don't Vote week with why eligible citizens don't register to vote. polls show that it's a combination of apathy, available time, lack of information, and other social and systemic barriers. In a 2020 poll of non-voters by NPR, 29% of non-voters surveyed said they didn't vote because they weren't registered. This and other polls show that non-voters consume less news media and are less engaged in the community than voters, so they may not see the announcements on how, when, and where to register and vote. A larger Knight Foundation study entitled The 100 Million Project, after the 100 million Americans who don't vote in national elections, found that 5% of non-voters cite not being registered, and 7% say they don't have time to vote. These reasons rank below don't like the candidates and voting doesn't matter in most studies, but if you're not registered, not liking the candidates is a moot point. Apathy is the biggest reason that people aren't registered. I'm not interested, don't care is the top reason, but I don't know how, it's too complicated, I keep forgetting, and I'm too busy are all cited factors. What can be done to reach and convince non-voters to register? We have some proposed solutions in our next report. We have links to studies and groups taking action at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. For the American Democracy Minute, I'm Brian Beal.
Now, from Survival comes an economical do-it-yourself fallout shelter.
Civil defense approved and easy to assemble. Takes just a weekend.
Get maximum protection from nuclear fallout for your family.
See a Survival shelter today.
Check, check, check. I think we are now live here from the WGXC Catskill studio. I'm Tom Rowan. I can't hear myself quite there. I can hear myself now. How are you guys doing out there in Radioland? Called the Shaker Show, where we focus on the Shaker Museum and something about Shaker history as it's... What anniversary is it this year?
It's the 250th anniversary of the Shakers arriving in America, what became America, in 1774. They traveled from England to New York.
So we've been having this show for quarterly to celebrate that and the local Shaker contributions of the museum. That voice you heard was Sarah Van Buren.
Hello.
And who else do we have here from the Shaker Museum world?
This is Dana Rasso. I'm the communications manager at Shaker Museum.
And Jerry Grant. I'm the director of collections and research.
And we've got a couple other people in the room. Are you guys going to talk, or are you just watching?
We can talk.
All right. Your mic is open, so you can talk if you want.
Okay. I think we'll just listen for a little bit, but we're here.
You want to just tell people your name so they, if they hear your voice, they'll know that it's you?
Okay. I'm Jess Ladin.
And I'm Paula Vitolo.
And Andrew Stein is going to be here in just a minute or so.
All right. And so I guess we'll hear who and why, all that in the course of the conversation. But what are we going to talk about today? What is our focus today on the Shaker Show?
Well, we're very close to, not only is this the 250th anniversary, but we're very close to the actual day, 250 years ago, when the Shakers landed here. It's called Landing Day. It's on August 6th. So we're going to give you a little bit of background about that.
August 6th?
August 6th. Is that what I said?
I think you did, yes. I was double-checking. Isn't that also Hiroshima? Is that a nuclear bomb day?
Whoa.
Too? So two kinds of explosions. Yeah. Very different kinds of explosions.
That's interesting.
And where was the landing?
So I should do a little bit of background for those few people who weren't following our quarterly Shaker Show. The Shakers are a monastic Christian religious group that had their origins around Manchester, England in the mid-1700s. And they were running in opposition to the Church of England, which was not a good thing to do at the time, and refused to become registered dissident religious groups. So they were persecuted by anyone who felt like they should do that. And they finally, I think, probably tired of that and found that the constant persecutions were cramping their ability to find new converts for their faith. And Their leader, a woman named Ann Lee, who was later called Mother Ann because of her position of authority, as a spiritual leader, had a revelation from heaven that they should come to America, where it would be an easier place, and they could open up their testimony, which for the Shakers meant they were announcing to the world that the second coming of Christ had appeared, had already occurred, and that all you had to do to join in that little band was to become a Shaker. So after some years of persecution, it was thought they should board up for the colonies, and they boarded a ship called the Maria, or Mariah, I guess in England, the Mariah, in Liverpool on May 19th, and set sail under Captain James Smith for New York City.
Is Captain James Smith a famous
name? He is not.
Oh, I thought I knew that name, but I guess it's just a very common name.
I think it's both names are pretty common. And I think especially in England, Smith was a pretty common name. So they actually came into port on August 5th and cleared customs. So the first notation of the Shakers being in America is in the customs house clearing list, where their ship was approved for disembarking probably in the night of August 5th, and on the morning of August 6th, they set foot on American soil for the first time. And the rest of the story gets really complicated.
And so it's the 250th from that first step onto American soil.
Right.
How far did they go back before the arriving here?
Really about 40 years. In various forms. They really coalesced as a group probably 10 or 15 years before they set sail for America.
So we're closing in on the 300th anniversary of the Shakers in total.
Of the beginning of the whole thing, yes. Yeah. And they came here only as a group of eight people. It wasn't a huge group. It never was a huge group in England. Their origins in England were really very akin and close to the new Methodist movement, which was taking place. And I think many of the early Shakers, in fact, had been Methodist at one point, had associated with them, and found that it was a faith, while they liked a lot of the tenets, they also felt that the Methodist Church had sold out to the Church of England by becoming registered dissidents and decided they wanted to separate from that group.
So I'm thinking the actual voyage, there's only eight of them on the ship, and there's a lot of other people?
There's probably a lot of other people.
So they're kind of the weirdos?
I'm not sure. That would be a word that I probably wouldn't use.
Right.
But
where would you use? I mean, they were outsiders.
They were definitely outsiders. And in fact, they continued their religious worship on board the ship. And because the Shakers sang and danced in their religious services, that was not well received by the captain. And at one point, the crew and captain threatened by Shaker history or lore, threatened to throw them all overboard. But at some moment after that, a wave hit the ship and knocked a plank loose, and the ship was in danger of sinking. The Shakers put their hands to help pump out the water as it was coming into the ship, and Mother Ann had another revelation that there was an angel watching over them, and as she announced that they were safe, another wave hit the ship and put the plank back in place. So we have one of those great stories, and then from then on, the captain...
The first act of the movie is already...
It's all scripted, yeah. And so we're set to go.
I think it might be interesting to give a little bit of background about Ann Lee, just a little snippet, just because of the fact that there may be some people listening who are not...
who haven't been following our quarterly Shaker show.
I think that there were obviously very many remarkable things about Mother Ann, just by virtue of the fact that she was a woman, for example, and led people, both men and women, to the New World. And the other part about it is that, you know, she was a very fervent, very passionate and charismatic speaker, but she was also illiterate. And so her interpretations of scriptures and things were not based on being a scholar, which kind of leads one to believe that she must have been a very compelling person to hear testify.
Yeah, she came out of a trades background. Her father was a blacksmith, and she eventually married a blacksmith who had been an apprentice to her father. The marriage had its shaky roots, because one of her other revelations was that all those who became Shakers should live a celibate life, not a real popular idea with her husband, who eventually, after following her to the colonies, fell in with the sinful nature of the world and abandoned her. So that also made it hard for them to make converts at that point. But once they got to America, they were more successful at that, and growing at one point to probably someplace between 4,000 to 5,000 members.
And so where did they go first?
Well, they settled in. Mother Ann ended up staying in New York City and working as a domestic helper. A couple of the Shakers went north to Albany and involved themselves in trades. One was one of the men was a weaver, and other people just found day labor, but they could barely, you know, support themselves. And they went north because they heard that there was land, and they were eventually, through the kindness of one of their members who was a little wealthier than the rest, were able to purchase some land around Colony, New York, just north of Albany in Niskayuna. And there they all eventually, within a couple years, all gathered together and created their first settlement. And from then on, they, weathering the American Revolution, where they were seen as suspect because they were British people coming with a lot of different ideas, and they were again persecuted in this country. When the war came to a close in New England, they then set out on a missionary journey for a couple of years, where they traveled throughout New England, visiting a lot of groups who had had some kind of religious revival going on. There was a lot of rejection of the, at that time, a lot of rejection of the established church in New England, and people were ripe for something different and something where they could participate more fully and personally than they could in the established churches. So a lot of people ended up following the Shakers, and they made converts in towns like Hancock, Massachusetts, and Enfield, Connecticut, and Harvard, Massachusetts, sending missionaries up into New Hampshire and Maine, and were able to make a substantial number of people, so that in 1787, when the Shakers decided to actually bond themselves together in an official community and make themselves an official church, they had little groups all through New England that were ready to follow and do the same. They relied on sort of communalism, living together equally in small communal families, and they were able to establish those throughout.
Do you know what you had to do to apply to be an official church in 1787?
I didn't. No, I think you just announced yourself as an official church.
There was no form.
There's no form. There's no corporate body. I think, you know, sometime in the 1830s, the Shakers were sort of forced to deal somewhat with the legal system and set up a system that was, you know, with trustees and such, that I think you would think most churches now had. But I think back then you could set up whatever you wanted to. And that all had to do with economics and inheritance and tech, you know, whatever.
And how were they received by the locals as these communities popped up?
People were suspicious of them. They were challenging, I mean, several things. They were challenging the natural family unit by breaking up families, having people live together communally, where children were removed from their families and raised by caretakers. Husbands and wives were separated from each other. People lived in, no longer lived as married couples. Challenged the natural family. They also, the idea of a woman religious leader was not real popular. Also, again, being communal, they were challenging sort of the economic system by sharing things in common. All they were trying to do is to go back what they felt was what the apostles had suggested how they should be living. And they felt quite innocent. They also, because they danced in their worship services, that wasn't real common in the other churches. So that was seen as foreign. So there's a whole lot of things that made them...
Almost every way they were different.
In almost every way they were different. Least, yeah.
And the other thing, I remember reading an account of the Shaker communities in Kentucky, and I don't remember if it was Ohio or Indiana during the Civil War, who of course, the Shakers did not discriminate based on race, and that was obviously quite radical at the time. And but I do seem to recall that they cared for people who were injured in battles on both sides. But they did fall under criticism during that time, right?
Yeah, I think in New England it wasn't so. There were African-American members of the Shakers from the very beginning, but there were never that many in New England, so it never became an issue, I don't think, like it was. In Kentucky at one point, at the community in South Union, Kentucky, which is really the far western southern part of Kentucky, that was more the south than it was the Midwest. And there, about one-third of the entire community was African-American, and there they had a lot of trouble with people for their racial, for their notion of racial equality.
And I mean, we're talking about like traits that might make someone suspicious or not like you. If you're treating both sides in a war, you're also irritating both sides.
Right. Yeah. I think the whole idea. The Shakers were also pacifists. So at the time of the revolution, they're also coming here being pacifists. Just to chalk up one more problem for them to
right.
become popular.
If you're not on our side, you're against us.
Right.
So pacifist is basically you're the other team.
Part of what overcame that is Shakers also were became really good farmers, really good neighbors, helped out the poor, helped out people in distress whose houses had burned or had problems like that. They also, at one point, they had sent 23 wagon loads of food to Hudson when Hudson had experienced a major fire, and just for the relief of people there. So they were seen
as... So
that
made people mad at them, too?
I don't think it made people mad. I think we're talking about the transition into where people started accepting them. And I think that their economics became useful because the Shakers manufactured good, honest, quality products that people could rely on. In the early days, they didn't even identify their products as being Shaker-made, but by the 1820s, they had become accepted enough in society that they proudly marketed themselves as Shaker goods.
So it was a if they would have marketed it at the beginning, people would not have bought it. But by the end, or later on, because we haven't gotten to the end yet, they're still Shaker.
They're still Shaker.
Now it's a proud thing that people search out and buy.
Right. Exactly.
Now would be a good time to segue into some contemporaneous Shaker stuff.
Yeah, I could give a little rundown of all the things that are coming up and also why we have our friends in the studio here with us from the Hudson Community Choir. So maybe first I'll just talk about what we have coming up this week. It's a big week. We're doing an open house in Chatham of our new library building at 29 Jones Avenue.
This is the Shaker Museum's new library building?
Yes. So it's still under construction, but we're having an open house as part of Chatham Summerfest, which is this Saturday. Chatham Summerfest is pretty much all day. Our open house will be from 1 to 4 o'clock, and you can come up to 29 Jones Avenue. It's very close to downtown Chatham. It's like right off of 295. It's a steep hill.
Chatham's not too large, so
yeah.
Ask around and they'll point you the way.
Exactly. It used to be a doctor's office, so if somebody grew up there, Dana grew up in Chatham.
Yes, it was my doctor's office.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So yeah, we'll be there just celebrating the next phase of Shaker Museum and drinking Prosecco and trying to stay cool. And then in tandem with that, down at the museum site, which of course is the building that's right off the Rotary in downtown Chatham, we have another project going on concurrently during Summerfest. I don't know if Dana, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. It's actually a really wonderful coalescing of a couple of different local entities, Shaker Museum being one of them, and then we are doing a mural on the material that's on the fencing around the building, which is at 5 Austerlitz Street. You can't miss it. It's a big building with blue windows. And we'll be working with a muralist named Josh Sarantitis, who has a nonprofit organization called Intersection, and he will be kind of leading folks and showing them how to paint in the stencils that they're going to be doing. And the stencils are sort of slight abstractions of some of the gift drawings that Shaker's made that are in our collection, as well as some of the iconic pieces of furniture that are in our collection. And the third collaborator on this is PS21, and they will be helping with volunteers and such. And also, I just want to plug that I believe it's from 1 to 3 or 1 to 4, there's a free juggling class seminar that they will be having.
Wait, are you going to be juggling?
No, this has nothing to do with me.
Shaker artifacts? Yeah,
exactly, yes. We are going to bring out the most expensive things. No, this is a PS21 is going to be holding this lesson down on their campus, which is down by Crowland Park, and they will be bringing people back and forth on a wagon of some sort. So all the more reason to come and check us out and then go learn some juggling and then come back and drink some Prosecco or whatever order you want to do that in. But yeah. So.
Did the Shakers juggle?
Did they?
No. There is actually a historic photograph of Shakers with what are those called that jugglers juggle? The bowling pins? Thing?
Yeah. Like what the are pins? The bowling pins called?
Yeah. Yeah,
I don't know.
There's a
pins?
Photograph of them with pins in their hands like that, but in fact they're doing calisthenics to strengthen themselves.
Oh.
But we could use that and say they were juggling.
Yes.
No.
Actually, that's interesting. You never told me about that photograph.
Oh, there's so much to learn, Dana.
And there's so much that Jerry has to tell us. I want to also mention that he and his wife, Sharon Kumler, who curated our current show at the Kinderhook Knitting Mill pop-up, Unexpected Shaker, he's going to be giving a talk with Sharon on Thursday, July 27th from, Saturday, July 27th from 3 to 4 o'clock. So it's sort of right after...
Three Saturdays from now.
Yes. The last Saturday of the month.
And that show is up now? Or
it's up now, yep.
Through this talk or through later?
Through this talk, yes. You can go and see the show. If you can't come to the talk, you can come Friday through Sunday to the Kinderhook Knitting Mill, and the gallery is open. Dana, do you remember the...
10 to 5 Friday and Saturday, and then 11 to 4 on Sundays. And it's on the second floor, but there is an elevator, so it is very accessible.
Yes. So come have lunch at Morning Bird Cafe, see the exhibit, come to the talk, and have dinner at the aviary. It's a whole day.
One-stop shop, yes.
And you can shop at the farmer's market.
Yeah, yes. That is Saturday, July 27th.
Yes, from 3 to 4 p.m.
Don't forget the Fix-It Picnic.
Yeah, we have those also. I'm just being mindful of our time. But yes, we are continuing our monthly Fix-It Picnic with Like-Minded Objects, which is a drop-in free mending workshop where we use fabrics and textiles and we upcycle them. And Elise McMahon and her team are there to instruct and help anyone that doesn't know how to do things already. The next two on Wednesday, July 24th and Wednesday, August 21st, they'll both be from 5 to 7:30 p.m. at Waterfront Wednesdays in Hudson on the riverfront and at the Henry Hudson Riverfront Park. The July one will feature Hanu. She's going to bring Indigo dye bath, so you can basically bring anything you want to dye indigo and throw it in the bath. So that should be a pretty fun communal experiment. I mean, it's an experiment.
Was there dyeing done by the Shakers?
Absolutely.
Yeah, they've been dying for centuries.
In fact, they were masters at indigo dyeing. There's a whole journal written about preparing indigo for dye baths. Yeah.
And you were running down the events. Did we get them all, or we got more?
Yes, we got them all, and I feel like this is a good segue to talk about our collaboration with Hudson Community Choir. Because Jess and Paula and Andrew are here, the heads of Hudson Community Choir. And we started talking about what if the choir sung some Shaker songs, because there's thousands of Shaker songs to potentially choose from. And Jerry selected a few books, and they went through them all and picked a couple of the songs, and then the choir sung them, and they're going to continue to sing them. And it's really beautiful. Mm-hmm. Did a great job.
Yeah. Do any of you guys want to talk about kind of the selection process, or like kind of how we came to pick what we ended up doing?
Yeah. When we... Sorry. Hi. Here I am.
I've got it turned up, so you don't have to get too close.
Okay. So when we were looking through these books that Jerry so graciously provided, I was already familiar with Simple Gifts. It was one that I had sung for a few different occasions when I was in choirs as a teenager. But I think we all kind of gathered around the second one we chose, which is Who Will Bow and Bend Like a Willow. And that wound up being the other one we chose because it just kind of grabbed us immediately. I think we all kind of said, wow, this is a really beautiful song. And the arrangement as it was a gorgeous little round refrain. And like a canon, and it came out beautiful. Yeah,
it definitely ended up being a singer favorite, and I think a crowd favorite when we performed it. Simple Gifts was, I think we all kind of, all of us, if you didn't know it, once you heard it, you knew it, but Who Will Bow and Bend was really, it was really beautiful, and I felt like singing it every time, it was just, you could really feel like the energy of the singers. They were just so happy to sing it, and it sounded beautiful. We loved performing it.
How is singing, how's it different than most singing?
I think, what we ended up doing, kind of like Andrew mentioned, was we sang a lot of them in rounds, and they're very melodic and they're pretty simple to learn. The choir, the tunes are easily recognizable, and they're very easy to pick up by just like call and response, and I felt like the choir just really, you know, took to it fast, and we were able to, you know, add dynamics, add expression, add emotion, maybe technically it wasn't that difficult, but you could really feel the energy and the emotion through all the pieces.
The Simple Gifts was originally just written as one straight through arrangement, but we changed it to be a canon. And for those of you who don't know what a canon is, it's like in Row, Row, Row Your Boat. You sing Row, Row, Row Your Boat, and then by the second time the next person comes in, we kind of treated both of those songs that way. But as Jess just said, and Paula, I think... Hi, Paula.
Hi.
We taught them as call and response, right?
Yeah, it was very by rote learning. I love the folk tune nature of these. It's very folk tradition. It's, you know, got those really open harmonies. Mm. And, you know, I think Simple Gifts is just in the consciousness of Americans, maybe because of Copeland's setting in Appalachian Spring, but maybe it's just like one of those songs you learn in Girl Scouts, you know? And so that's a real like draw in for the crowd to be like, oh yeah, this tune that we all know is a Shaker tune. And then the second one being just so gorgeous. We all fell in love with it immediately both for the lyrics, the imagery of the words are so spiritually profound, and it was really enriched by Sarah's presentation that she did with the choir. And we all just really connected with it even further. But yeah, Who Will Bow and Bend was a great one to be introduced to sort of broaden our listening of Shaker tunes, and I would love to know more.
Yeah,
totally. They were definitely, you know, when Sarah came to us with the idea of collaborating, you know, we thought it was really cool, but I was like, I don't know, is the choir going to think this is really cool? Because, I mean, we thought it was all, and they just totally took to it. And the choir is, you know, we're a choir of all ages, all abilities. You know, we have kids that are 8 years old in the choir. We have people that are in their 70s in the choir. So it's a pretty big range of people, and everyone took an interest. The younger kids took an interest. The older generations took an interest. And Sarah came towards kind of the end of our rehearsal season and gave this amazing presentation about kind of the history of the Shakers, but also like the origins of Shaker music and what a lot of the history behind the words that we were singing were. There were so many references that, you know, it put it so much more in context, especially with Who Will Bow and Bend. It almost took us, felt like we were there, and like took us back to singing these pieces that are, you know, have been around for so long, and seeing like, you know, kids singing it was really awesome for us.
I also love the 2- and 3-part nature of these songs. It really just lends itself to like group singing. You know, this spirit of community really comes through in the songs. To have different separate groups singing the same melodies overlapping, it's just a really beautiful thing to behold.
Do you find that the themes of the songs resonate today, that they still make sense across centuries?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think today there's probably a lot of people who can relate to wanting to slow down and kind of simplify things, you know? I think we're a bit inundated with information and narratives that pull us in all different directions, and these songs kind of distill it down to, at least when I was singing them, I found that I was very like at ease and feeling a peace of mind. Anyone else? Sorry about that. Anyone else?
I was just going to say with Bow and Bend, I do think that it did remind me of kind of, you know, singing through like the things you do throughout the day. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's something that I think we all still do, and something they did, like just kind of singing throughout while you're, you know, doing your laundry or doing, you know, cooking or cleaning the kitchen or just all these things that we're always, like, at least me, I'm always singing and doing things and, like, singing, I'll, like, sing out what I'm doing as I'm doing it. And I felt like that song, even though it was just so beautiful, it did remind me of kind of just, like, the simpleness and dailiness of life. And I do think, yeah, it was nice to have repertoire like that was just, yeah, kind of like recentering and like going back to this just relaxing state, because yeah, the world is crazy, and like these songs were very, yeah, very zen, I felt like.
Maybe this is a question for you, Sarah, or maybe you guys. It sounds like whoever wrote these songs kind of made them accessible to many different skills. They're probably singers in the communities that sang very well, and others that were like really into singing but were not the greatest singers. But maybe it sounds like these songs were written sort of so they were kind of easy to for everyone to sing along to. Is that, am I reading into things, or
I think that's a question for Jerry.
In the first place, Shaker music until the 1870s was all without harmonies. So it was a single melody line. It was generally an A-A-B-B repeating series of words. So even today, if you attend meeting at Sabbath Day Lake, Maine, where there are still 2 remaining Shakers, and they hold public meeting every Sunday at 10 o'clock, and people are welcome to come, they sing a lot during meeting. And if you've never been there, as you hear the people who know the song sing the first line, you know it's coming around again, so you can, the second line time you can join in. I think the incredible importance of both music, song, and dance in Shaker worship was one of the things that really bound them together in community, and a critical part of keeping people working together, living together, loving together. I think you guys, the choir, feels that at this point, the importance of that. I often equate this in a very odd connection. The reason that the military does close order drill for so long was to bind people into some kind of community where you're relying and moving together in a big physical mass. Does build community. If you've ever done square dancing or contra dancing or any other form of dance, you know that you can go into that and immediately feel some kind of communal bonding up with the other people you're participating, whether you've ever met them or not. Singing does the same thing. So Shaker music was also done a cappella, so there was no musical instruments involved. So very simple, very straightforward, easy to learn.
Was there like a genius writer, or these songs were written by many, many different people over the years, or?
Many people. Some songs were written by people intentionally. There's a lot of Shaker music that is assumed to have been given through some kind of revelation where people would receive a song.
Is there authorship?
There are authorships for some. Like Simple Gifts is written by Elder Joseph Brackett at Sabbathy Lake or at Alfred Main. I tend to say Sabbathy Lake, but a lot of the other songs we know who. Some of the Shaker hymnals, which were kept in manuscript form, have the name of the people who wrote it, but more often the community where it was from or where it was known to be have been written.
And were there like hits? You know, like all of a sudden this song spread from Shaker community and everybody was singing it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think so, but I don't think we can document that. But by how
that's
often they...
Speakers, right?
Well, because the Shakers would copy things out of other people's hymnals and manuscripts. I think you could go through and do an analysis of how many different communities these songs appeared in their hymnals, and you could actually see them. The spread, if they were dated, it would be even better, but you can see that some songs appear in hymnals from Maine to Kentucky, and some songs don't. Some only appear in one place, probably not a big hit, but yeah.
Is there a scholar of just Shaker music, or you're like...
No.
You're covering it all.
I'm not covering it all.
You're trying to.
No, the main scholar at this point is quite elderly. His name is Daniel Patterson. He was taught at, he was an ethnomusicologist from University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he wrote the major book on Shaker music, but there's another dozen or dozen and a half books on different aspects of Shaker music. Many, many hymnals have been rewritten. Shakers wrote in a letter notation, not in standard round note. So there are some scholars who can sing from the letter notation, which is a challenge. But there are a number of people who have learned to do that, so they can translate Shaker letter notation into round notes and make it. And you can just, you know, there are many groups that have recorded Shaker music. You know, probably the best known is Boston Camerata, who've done a couple of albums of Shaker music. But Library of Congress recorded the Shakers. I mean, there's
no top 40 hits, though?
Well, Simple Gifts is going to be at the top of the list anywhere, but not necessarily the best song, but certainly one of the best known.
There's some good deep cuts. Yeah.
Deep cuts.
How about, you guys want to tell us a little about the chorus? And is this something unusual for you, or is this something you guys do often?
So Hudson Community Choir is actually only a year and a half old. So can you hear me better? Okay. Yeah, we started back in the spring of 2023. So this is the first kind of like musical collaboration that we've ever done. We've sung with, other organizations and with other, like four other events in Hudson and kind of around, but this was the first, collaboration where we, were singing pieces that we worked together on, we picked together, which was amazing. And the choir, it's a free choir. It runs, we have a fall session and a summer session. We're free. We meet every Thursday at Hudson Hall. This is our last week, actually, of the summer session. So it's technically a spring summer session, but it's free. It's non-audition. It's people of all ages and all abilities. And it's led by Andrew, and Paula is our assistant conductor and our accompanist.
Do you guys start it, or
who started it?
I started it with Anise Cousin, who is the head of Beautiful Racket Hudson. She is actually at the waterfront today at Waterfront Wednesdays.
They're performing
at 7, so she can't be here today, but she wanted to be here. But I started with Anise and Charisse Johnson, who works at Kite's Nest for, I believe, like 8 or 9 years. So we started it that way, and then we brought on Andrew as a conductor, because none of us, we had a vision, but we didn't know who was going to lead the group. And then after a semester, we realized we needed an accompanist and we needed some extra support. And then the lovely Paula came to us and has been amazing, and both of them have been incredible leaders.
So you guys,
what are you two do?
Well, I'm the assistant director and accompanist of this choir, and I have to say I love this choir. I feel so at home, and I didn't even know I was missing a choir until this came into my life. I also want to say this collaboration with the Shaker Museum, I think, going back to the relevance of these songs, the Shaker community really aligns with, I think, Beautiful Racket's vision for this choir and our own ideals for ourselves, and I think that is the true relevance of this collaboration and how wonderful it's been to do that. And the community that we experience in this choir, we want to make it really welcoming, and it brings together so many diverse people from the Hudson community that maybe are meeting for the first time and getting to sing together, which is like the most joyful expression of being a human. And I think the Shakers are really on board with that. So have loved working with the Shaker Museum. I've learned crazy things that I had never thought I would know. And, it has special relevance for me because my birthday is on August 6th, the day that the Shakers came to, the States. The first semester I worked with you, I was just the accompanist, and now I've kind of expanded my capacity and have taken on a little bit of leadership, just mainly, working with Andrew equally and helping each other out. It's been really great.
Yeah. For me personally, don't you love when people start a sentence like that? I was, like Paula said, not realizing that this was something that I was missing. I am someone who sang in choirs, like I had mentioned, since I was a really young kid, and studied all through college, jazz studies, vocal performance. And when I was in college, I got the opportunity to musically direct an a cappella group and a student-run theater company, and that kind of ignited what I think was that love of having a group that you can really dig into and kind of refine something over time, and the people kind of grow together and create this new thing that didn't exist before. And in the time since, I've spent a lot of time teaching music lessons and musically directing local theater companies. But when Jess, Charisse, and Anise asked me if I wanted to conduct this choir, it was like, it just seemed like something that, like, I can't believe it doesn't exist already. Let's do this. Like, what are we waiting for, And sure enough, within the first season of it, and as we've kind of hinted around, I was responsible for playing piano and conducting that first season, and that was intense. And I'm so grateful, so grateful for Paula's help there. But even that first season, which was, a little bit of a rough start, we really had an incredible turnout, and we've had that turnout ever since of people who come up to me at the end of the season and say, this is amazing, I've never sung before. I'm like, what do you mean? I mean, I'm the director of it, so I get to say this with some bias, but we sound pretty good for a community choir, you know?
Yeah, I think you sound great. Thank you, Sarah. I think that the kind of what, you know, Andrew was saying is we started off with maybe 20 singers, 25, which was way more than we even anticipated. We were going to be happy with 10 singers. We did not think that this was going to expand the way it has, and now we've had, I think at our friends and family performance this past spring, we had 45 singers, which was just beyond, and it just continued, and with Andrew's leadership and with Paula's, you know, leadership as well, like, the, just people that, yeah, have never sung before, people that don't read music, kids that just really just wanted to come to hang out with their friends that now are so into it, like, seeing that, and their passion for it grow is just, like, the best feeling, and I've gotten emails from people that, like, you know, choir was the first time they left their house, really, since the pandemic, it was the first time they were doing something, they didn't feel like they kind of lost themselves, they didn't have a passion after COVID, and then they started doing this, and so those are the, you know, I think we sound amazing, and but those are, like, the things that I hear that make me, like, wow, like, I'm so glad we're doing this, because music does change everything for people. It's the most positive thing, I think, for the soul and for community. So, yeah, it's grown exponentially over the past year and a half.
I would also say that, yeah, along with I've never sung before, or, you know, I haven't done this in a long time, people love to tell me that they have not sang in a choir since they were in grade school or high school, and that that was their favorite part of the day. And this is such a great outlet for that. And I can say that we all leave in such a better mood, just totally uplifted.
And so is there an audition process, or is all comers? Or
yeah, absolutely. The only auditions that we'll have are right at the end of the season when we do, like, solo auditions. Otherwise, if you're interested in joining the choir, please do. Especially if you have a low voice. We always need more
and
people with
like
low
even
voices.
If you don't know what part you sing, we'll
yeah,
figure
we'll
it out.
We'll figure it out. And we're used to that. And you, like, I think, okay, and going back, Paul, to what you just said about, like, a lot of people have that experience with choir in their childhood. A lot of people also have the experience of trying to be in choir and feeling left out, or you know, having the people up top kind of throwing around words that they don't understand. And that's something that we kind of tried to get on top of, especially this past season, of laying out, like, terminology stuff right off the bat and kind of making sure that the environment was accessible for everyone equally, and creating stuff like practice tracks and stuff so that there's enough resources for everyone to kind of, you know, be in it together.
Yeah, and I think, too, for anyone thinking about joining, for right now, thank you to Hudson Hall, our webpage for choirs on the Hudson Hall webpage, they provide us with the space to rehearse and to perform. It's very loose. I get people that'll email me, I can't make rehearsal. I'm like, that's the reason why it's a community choir. You don't have to come to everything. It's very, you know, all of our performances are optional. It's very come sing after work, but, you know, we do learn pieces and we do perform, and it's very low pressure. And yeah, I love the fact that it's non-audition, and that even if you just want to come and try it out. Sarah was in choir the first time around. She's an OG, like, singer.
That's true.
Yeah. So, you know, everyone can come and try it.
And
So you go to the Hudson Hall website to find your website and find out more information about the chorus?
Mm-hmm.
And the Hudson Hall is obviously the Hudson Opera House, which was, if you know the history, Opera House was the local meeting house. So sort of the Shakers had their version of that, whatever, the big hall where they sang in, probably, right?
Meeting house.
It's kind of the same tradition in some ways. I mean, this was like the big entertainment for the Shakers, as well as a way to make community the way you guys are describing, right?
Well, the same. Shaker worship was public worship, the worship that they had where they invited the public in because they hoped to make converts, since they weren't producing their own. Was essential, and their public meeting, for those, they actually had singing meetings in the evening to rehearse songs, and then it was really performance. So
did
they,
everyone sing, or just people that were in, interested?
I think not everyone sang, but most of the people were encouraged to sing.
Same with dancing?
Sometimes they would have set aside a group of singers that would sing while other people danced, just because doing both together for a dance that might last 15 or 20 minutes got to be pretty exhausting. So.
All right. So what have we, we're almost out of time here. What have we forgot to mention on this quarterly edition of the Shaker Show? We're joined here today by Sarah Van Buren, Dana Rasso, Jerry Grant, and you guys from the Hudson Community Chorus. Is that what it's called?
Choir.
Community Choir. Choir. And say your names again.
Andrew Stein.
Paul Levitolo.
Jess Ladin.
And so what have we forgotten to tell our listeners here?
I just want to wrap it up by saying you guys are very welcome to come and look at more Shaker music anytime. And put it together, we'll find a place for you to perform some of it. Or Sarah will. I won't. Sarah will.
Yeah, aren't you guys performing soon?
Yes. So this Saturday at the Hudson Waterfront, we will be performing with the Hudson Festival Orchestra. In their penultimate number, I was just looking at the score earlier today because I get to guest conduct this song. We'll be singing We Are the World, the classic pop ballad that saved
Wait,
us.
Is everybody like doing a different role? Like, who's Lionel Richie?
You know, early on we decided to not do it that complicated because
you didn't have a Bruce Springsteen.
Paula, I did do a Bruce Springsteen for you.
Yeah, we've got a great Cyndi Lauper, and also a lot of the kids have solos, which I love. It
yes.
sounds so good.
The kids, I will say, are the most fierce when it
yeah.
comes to this choir. They are so into it. When some of them were absent at the last rehearsal, other ones took over, these little kids, to sing this.
That's great.
Yeah, amazing.
They are fearless.
Yes.
So, yeah, come down to the waterfront. We're performing at
8:30, 8:40.
It's up there, so.
Yeah.
But come here, come for the kids. The kids are going to make you very happy.
Mm-hmm. So that is Saturday at the Hudson Waterfront, and tonight at the Hudson Waterfront, Beautiful Racket is there at 7. Is that what you said before?
Yes, that's right.
All right, and what else do we have? Any other dates we want to re-mention, those ones you mentioned before?
Yeah, I guess you can make a whole day of it, because on Saturday we have our open house from 1 to 4 p.m.
That's
in
right.
Chatham at 29 Jones Avenue, and we have the mural painting project, which is just down the hill. And then you can make your way over to Hudson, maybe like take a dip, swim in between, mm-hmm. and then go see Hudson Community Choir and the Hudson Festival Orchestra at 8 o'clock.
The heat's going to break by then, right?
Oh, I hope so.
We all hope so, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, anything else, Jerry?
I think we're all set.
All right. I think our other guests are here, so we can make a transition. You guys can... enjoy the art on your way out in the Nonchalant Gallery, and then we'll see you in October, September?
Yes. October.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. The little steel strike was beginning to collapse. Strikers in Massillon, Ohio had gathered that Sunday night at union headquarters across from Republic Steel's Massillon Works. As Ahmed White describes in his book, The Last Great Strike, the union had organized weekly festivities on Sunday nights, including food, live music, and dancing. For weeks, the Law and Order League had repeatedly demanded special police be deputized and armed to crush the strike. By early July, Ohio National Guardsmen ensured the forcible reopening of the mill. One self-appointed special deputy leader, Major Curley, decided tonight would be the night he was going to, quote, clean out that goddamned hall. He provocatively positioned his deputies in front of Union headquarters. First, he ordered his deputies to fire on picketers attempting to block the gate at shift change. When strikers hurled bottles and rocks in response, the deputies unleashed massive rounds of gunfire and tear gas for more than half an hour. Guardsmen, railroad, and company police joined in the anti-SWAC siege. Two strikers were dead. Nick Valdos was shot in the hip as he attempted